Welcome back to another episode of the Hip Hop Social Workers Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott, and today I've connected with somebody I met through my brother, because my brother knows many of people, and ever since I met him, the first time I met him, we were talking about like little brother. Then I seen him at a little brother concert, and I was like, oh yeah, so you for real? You really on the little brother tip? Go ahead and introduce him. His name is Salong. You know what I'm saying? You live in Tacoma, right?
Yep, I live in Tacoma. I was raised here in Tacoma, but I was born in Cambodia, came here as a refugee, but I did live in Portland for a good at least 10 years. I worked out there at Intel and Roller Acres in Hillsboro. So pretty familiar with the Portland scene. I didn't grow up there, but I spent a lot of my adult life there. Met my wife there. So I love Portland, man. It's a second home to me. I always frequent it there. I got a lot of family there.
Okay. Yeah. They still here, huh?
They still there, man. I know the Cambodian population in Portland, not as big as up here in the Tacoma, Seattle area, but there's quite a bit of a presence. As a kid, I used to go up to Portland a lot, man. I hung out, you know, where Cleveland High School is around Powell. Mm-hmm. That area, I used to, that's my old stomping grounds. But I lived all over. I lived in Hillsboro, Beaverton for a little bit, Portland for a little bit, then Vancouver before I moved back here to Tacoma.
Okay. Okay, yes, sir. So what were you doing in the Cleveland area?
I was there to visit my aunt, man, my aunt and cousin. I'd stay at her house the whole summer just to get away from the Tacoma area, because Tacoma used to be pretty bad too, but then Portland was so much better as far as gang violence goes in the Asian community. So luckily I didn't know too many folks out in the Portland area doing the same thing. So I was just there for the summer just to stay out of trouble here. My parents used to send me there. So my family, you know, my cousins, my aunt took care of me, and just a different scenery for me.
Okay, yeah. Sometimes it's good to switch it up, you know. Me and my family lived in Tacoma for like a year, but I was still young. Okay. I don't really remember it, but my dad, I got a job out there. But anyway, so yeah, I want you to come on the podcast because I seen like you big in the community work in Tacoma. You was named like one of the top Tacoma voices, you know what I'm saying? I was like, okay, my guy's out here really, really pushing the narrative, you know what I'm saying? Your Twitter account is brilliant. You know, your social media.
Thank you. Stuff,
you know what I'm saying? So, but once I learned that you like worked in like in the community, I was like, I got to see what's up. So, so go ahead and tell me a little bit about how you got to the position you're in right now. Cause you said you worked at Intel. So like, sound like you went from like, from like corporation work to like, service work.
Right. Well, the service work is really important to me because I came over here as a refugee. So service work for me was embedded in me as a kid, because you have to understand that my parents came here with nothing. They didn't go to school. They barely spoke English. They learned the language, but they're still not fluent. So when I was able to read and write English, it wasn't until the third grade, right? Mm-hmm. I was in ESL from first to kindergarten to third grade. But once I started learning how to read and comprehend, probably fifth or sixth grade, beginning of middle school, where my parents would get letters in the mail and they would have me translate if I needed to apply for certain social services. I was the one, because I was the oldest as well. So service started for me at a young age. By the time I was 9, 10, I was a social worker for my parents. I would accompany them to translate English to appointments they had at the Department of Health and Human Services to get our, you know, welfare and all that. But, you know, so service work has always been a part of my life. I just didn't know it yet. Okay. So as I grew up, I learned that there was a need there to not assist only my parents, but also their friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was the obligation for me, who has not going and will go through education system in the United States, which is deemed to be the best in the 80s and 90s. And it wasn't a decision of mine to become this person to serve the community and uplift the community. It kind of came onto my plate, and it was a calling. So at that point, I kind of realized that, you know, this is part of my identity, to serve who helped get me here. and to continue to serve people that are more unfortunate than I am. So I'm in a really, really blessed and privileged position to be where I am today, to be able to do the work that I do. So let's fast forward to today. I was in the corporate private sector for a long time because, you know, growing up, you're taught to go to school and get a good job. I really never got a good job. I was moving jobs from here to here, but Intel, I stayed with Intel for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I realized that I wasn't happy, man. I was making pretty good money and doing okay. And then I felt empty inside, you know, like, what am I doing for the rest of my life? So I started learning things that I didn't know what to do. Music for one was an outlet. Graphics for one is an outlet, and learning how to do video to kind of communicate the message. You know what I'm saying? So this serving the community is part of who I am. So I was really never able to escape it, no matter how hard I tried, because you know, fulfilling and that self happiness thing wasn't there in a corporate situation. So you know, and once you learn that money isn't everything, I was able to accept that, you know what, I can take this pay cut and come into the service sector, because it means a lot more than me. I'd rather be doing this than making billions of dollars and not helping nobody out.
You know, and that's a good point, because, like, you know, like you said, like once you realize that those tangible assets, you know what I'm saying, like, aren't everything, it's kind of like you can do a little bit more maneuvering, you know what I'm saying? Because I know, like, people chase certain things, you know, then once you get it, it's like, man, that wasn't really as tight as I thought it would be, you know.
Absolutely. You start to understand that the meat of everything is in the journey, right? The happiness is in, and everything that you try to achieve, this goal that you try to reach, you learn the values in the journey on what you learn throughout to get to that goal. But once you get to that goal, you're like, so what's next?
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So there's always something to conquer. There's always something to reach for. And once you get there, there's always something else. Once you learn that the value and your value and your worth is in the journey itself and not the actual destination. And once I realized that for myself, I realized, like, okay, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. It's just to continue to reach out and give a hand to those who needs it. That I want to be, you know, the cliche is to be the person you want to be when you need it, someone, you know, and I live by that.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of social workers get into that field for the same reason. Just kind of like, you know, there was somebody that helped them out when they was a kid, or, you know, they grew up helping a lot of people, or, you know, they was in a rough spot and a social worker came and showed them, like, the way out. So, like, they feel like, you know, like, that they were so grateful for that person or for that system to help them that they would decide to get in that system themselves, you know. But you're in an interesting spot, because a lot of kids that I work with now are kind of like in your same position. Like, they're the oldest of families of parents who maybe not speak English, and the oldest, like, sibling has to, like, take on like the brunt of that, of everything, you know what I'm saying? So, like, could you, like, maybe, like, you know, explain, like, how that was, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like, how much of a daunting task that had to have been.
You know, it was daunting because you have your homework that you have to do growing up, and you're struggling with these issues that you are with yourself too. I mean, being a refugee from a different country, trying to assimilate to American culture, me personally, and I'm speaking for myself here, you struggle a lot with identity issues, trying to figure out who you are and where your place in this world. So on top of that, you have to manage your parents' well-being as well. You help them out where they can't. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure, but at the same time, you take that pressure and you roll with it, because the obligation is your parents are working hard every day to provide food on the table. The least that I can do is help them translate these documents, fill out this application, go to them with appointments, because not knowing English, being a non-English speaker at the beginning of my life, there's a lot of confidence that you lack for not being able to speak the language of the country that you're in. Mm-hmm. So you always feel like you're being judged for not saying the words correctly. Even till this day, I feel like that. I feel like, you know, there's certain words I don't know, sentences I can't write completely, you know what I'm saying? So it's really a, like you said, a daunting task, but it's something that you take upon yourself to just you roll with it. You just deal with it, and you got, this is something that we have to do. So I mean, I don't know if I answered your question, but it's just something that, you know, you just do it. You don't think about it. This is one of the tasks of the day that I have to do. I'm going to relate that to growing up being poor. When you grow up poor, you don't know you're poor. It's just, that's the daily life. Growing up in the hood, you don't even grow up in the hood. You know, you go out there and you see a crackhead across the street, but then you, not even a block away, there's kids playing and stuff. So it's just, it becomes normalized to be able to do what I did, you know, to be the social worker for your parents and their friends. It's just, that's just part of life.
Mm-hmm. And you did answer what I was asking, I feel like some people, like when they hear like these stories of like, oh man, you know what I'm saying? He's the oldest, his parents don't speak English. He got to do this, that. Like, I feel like they still aren't getting the fact that like, yeah, he has homework to do, but you know, like he has a lot of other things to do as mm-hmm. well. Or she has a lot of things to do as well. So like, maybe let's learn a little bit about the situation before we like just kind of hone in on the academics, you know what I'm saying?
Right. And it's a cultural thing too. It's a cultural thing too. Being Asian American, Cambodian American specifically, we're more of a village type mentality, right? Everybody kind of take care of each other. So everybody has their certain roles that they do. Since I spoke English and read English, my role was to be the translator and, you know, go to these appointments. Whereas, you know, when my younger brother was coming up, they had their tasks and obligations as well. And once they grew up and kind of learned, you know, they took the tasks that I couldn't do. And, you know, it was a team effort, and we saw ourselves as a family unit. By all means, it wasn't easy, but I think relating to back to growing up the way that I did, the beauty is actually in the struggle itself. You know what I mean? If you notice, a lot of people that's grown up well off with you know, just have everything they need, and they have never ever have to struggle for anything. They tend to be more disconnected from humanity and from empathy. They don't empathize as much as we do, who grew up having to struggle and seeing other people struggle.
Yeah. And I, you know, I feel the same way, because like I worked with some pretty like affluent people in social work, and some of the things that they, you know, that they compare like their lives to like some of the youth we work with lives. Like I had one, I had one coworker who was complaining about like these youth not like doing the homework on time, you know what I'm saying? And she was like, you know, when I was a kid, I had two hours to do my homework. And I was kind of thinking like, well, you also had horses too. So like, you know, so.
Yeah, it's a different background, different coming. Yeah, horses? How many people do you know have horses? I have zero.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So I feel like, you know, like I feel like it's important for you to kind of like people like yourself who like came over, parents came over, didn't speak English, you the oldest, so you have to learn a language. I mean, once you learn a language, you're like, I'm not just learning a language to like just to have fun with. I'm learning a language so we can like make some moves.
Survive. You know, yeah, we're surviving, you know.
Yeah. So it's different. So. It's so different. And I just love to, you know, like the more stories like that. Like we break down the stigma and barrier of like, you know, oh, this kid's not working because he's lazy, or this kid's not working because he doesn't get it. Like, no, this kid's probably a little slow, not slow like that, but he's a little slow to turn his work in because he got so much other things to do, you know.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Barriers, man. There's barriers and obstacles that every day that people go through that we're unaware of. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to be mindful of that if you don't experience. And I try to check myself every day when I talk to people, just, you know, try to empathize with them.
Yeah, that's real, you know. So you said you grew up doing music as an outlet of like, you know, kind of, I'm sure it was stress and, you know, it's kind of like this emotional release, you know what I'm saying? So like, how did you get into doing the music thing?
The music thing really, it just came natural to me. All my cousins in Portland, they have a band called the Bayon Band. If you're in the Cambodian community in the Portland area, they're legends. They've been doing this since they got here in the 80s. And now my cousins and nieces and nephews are taking over the band. So they're a band that plays Cambodian music. And that was at weddings and parties and New Year's parties for the Cambodian community out there in Portland, Oregon. And I would attend those parties, and that's where I really just, I mean, I've heard music all my life growing up, but I didn't really understand how music worked, right? So at one of those parties, maybe I was about 10 or 11, man, I was watching my uncles and older cousins play music, and I noticed each person had an instrument, right? Each person had an instrument, and all those instruments are in sync, playing different things, but making this beautiful harmony of sounds, and I was really intrigued by that. In middle school, I grew up around my friends who listened to a lot of the West Coast Bay Area hip hop, JT the Bigger Figure, hey. Mac Maul, E40 and all them, and Too Short. And honestly, it wasn't me. I wasn't really feeling that type of music because I wasn't a gang member. I can't fight. So I liked the music, but I couldn't relate to it. So I strayed away from hip hop during my middle school years, and I listened to a lot of the Cure. The Smiths was one of my favorite bands back then. And also, you know, grunge was huge back then too. So of course, Nirvana, yeah. Pearl Jam, Metallica, the Black Album. I still listen to that album today. So I was exposed to that alternative rock during middle school. But once, I got into high school, my freshman year, I discovered the Wu-Tang Clan. My cousin, Aria, actually, she gave me a tape, right? And I don't know where she got the tape from, but it said the Wu-Tang Clan on it. I'm Cambodian, Asian. I was like, yo, is this an Asian rap group? I did not know because the cover of the album was all face, right? So I put it on. I'm like, yo, this shit is hot. I've heard the beats, RZA. And I figured out they weren't black when the N-word was, you know, all over the album. Yeah. So, you know, there's no internet back then. I was reading the credits. I used to read the credits of all the inserts of the tapes back then, and that's just one of my favorite hobbies that I don't do anymore. But anyways, I started making beats. I heard RZA's beats, and it really inspired me because they were so grimy and so, like, just the grittiness of it, the sounds of it, and to me, it sounded so simple but so powerful and effective. So I really started making beats because of RZA. I saved up my money, bought a keyboard and started learning how to sequence music on, I had a Yamaha PSR 510. It was like a $300 keyboard. I started making beats on that. Mm-hmm. And then I started getting better and better and better. So I made beats. I can send you some after this.
Okay.
I started making beats and I met a couple of cats here in Fort Lewis. They were also hip hop producers from like New Jersey. And I forgot what his name was, really older dude. I was like 17 at the time. He took me to the barracks and showed me a MIDI sequencer. First time I ever seen anything like that. So you connect it to the keyboard because I used to make beats and I would play a drum pattern for like a minute and lay it on top of that with a MIDI sequencer. You can take it and loop a 4-bar drum and just loop it over and over and create your sequence like that. Anyways, I started making beats. I want to take this back to the identity thing that I brought up earlier. Growing up, I really didn't feel Cambodian enough. I didn't feel American enough. But when I discovered Wu-Tang Clan, Mobb Deep, Nas, Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt, I discovered the hip-hop culture. I understood. I listened to it. I read everything about it. And then back in the 90s, hip hop was all about knowledge itself. The God is the earth and the woman is the earth. The man is the God. You know, the 5% philosophy that was really rampant and was really going and big in hip hop that time. And I really took to that philosophy of freedom of self, knowledge itself and self-expression. So I really got into the New York hip hop culture. I was really into it while my friends were still doing, you know, the West Coast hip hop.
Yeah.
And I just started writing. I learned how to write rhymes with listening to Nas. I would write his rhymes down to figure out his patterns and his cadence. And I was able to record a couple of songs myself on a little Iowa stereo. And I was just hooked. And I just kept doing it back then. And finally, in 05, I dropped a collaborative album with a couple of friends and my cousins, which did pretty well up in Seattle. We had airplay, and this is way before the internet, so we were out in the streets. We had our CDs at Best Buy. Best Buy Tower Records back then. And,
hey, there we go.
Tower Records. And in the Tacoma area, there's a really big black record label called Ocean Records. They put out rap music from the Tacoma, Seattle area. And I was brave enough to go to Ocean Records. It's a little shop plus a record label, the studio. And I say, hey, man, I got an album. Would you like to hear it? And the owner, I forgot what his name was, really nice dude. He looked at me because I'm Asian, right? He goes, you rap? I'm like, yeah, I rap and make beats. And he started laughing. I'm like, that's fine. That's cool. I understand. Because, you know, Asians back then wasn't really doing rap music and hip hop, right?
Yeah.
And he played it. It's like, yo, this is pretty good, man. But I'm telling you, he tells me, whatever you do, just stay true to who you are yourself. He played it. He liked it. He's the first one I bought. He bought like 50 CDs wholesale so he can sell it. I'm probably sure he didn't sell any, but just the support he showed me really gave me the confidence to continue to go to Tower Records. They do consignment with Best Buy and all that stuff. So yeah. I have to give credit to the dude from Ocean Records. I feel bad for not remembering his name, for giving me a break, making me feel like what I did was okay as a non-black person doing black music, right?
Yeah.
So that really planted a seed in my head that, you know, hip hop is definitely a culture. You know, it's black culture that created from New York. But if you look at hip hop, it's worldwide now. Because hip hop is the language of poverty, the language of nothing, taking nothing and making something out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why it resonates with so many different underprivileged communities.
Yeah. And that's real, you know, and I know like that's where I get my name, the hip hop social worker, and mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. Because that's the culture I come from, you know what I'm saying?
Word.
Like, yeah, yes, I come from the black culture too, but hip hop culture, you know, like I can connect with so many different people just, you know, speaking the hip hop language, and people are like, oh yeah, I know so and so, or you know, like I might walk in an older guy, you know, walk into a unit with a whole bunch of, you know, 17, 18 year olds, and they, you know, listening to something. I'm like, absolutely. Oh yeah, that's so and so. They're like, oh. And all right there, it's like, oh yeah, this
absolutely. Same thing, man. When I was between the Cambodian and American culture, hip hop it centered me. You know what I'm saying? Like you said, hip hop, it's a universal culture now, but you can talk to anybody and figure out if they're into hip hop, the same music as you do. There's a bond and connection there immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's real. So, us being social workers. You know, even though you're like, you know, I don't know if you like actual, like, you know, therapist or not, you know what I'm saying? But mental health is everywhere, you know what I'm saying? Especially mm-hmm. communities of color, you know, absolutely. We feel like we're like 50 years behind on the mental health curve, you know what I'm saying? So like, how have you seen like mental health in your community? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, what has been like the challenges, the things you might have conquered, you know what I'm saying, like, you know, the progress, just kind of overall, like, you know, so like, what would you say,
yeah,
like, you know, health is in, you know, the Tacoma Cambodian community?
Okay. I can't speak for the Tacoma as a whole, but I can speak about the Cambodian community and mental health that is very non-existent. The conversation of mental health is very non-existent in the Cambodian community. There's not even a word for it, I don't think, in Khmer, the Cambodian language. Because if you think about it, our parents, it's only been 45 years since the genocide of the Cambodians. They came here, war-torn country. On top of the trauma, they had to navigate a whole new world, a whole new society, a whole new set of standards and learning how to navigate the American way of doing things. So I don't think as mental health in the Cambodian community, I don't think as a whole community, hasn't had time to heal or even address it. Only recently, the past couple of years, that I've met people, you know, from this generation that's talked about more mental health. I know a Cambodian woman who's going to school for it, and she's one of the first that I've ever met in my 41 years of life that's Cambodian that's even talking about mental health. So non-existent, even people experiencing trauma, we don't even have a word for trauma or PTSD. So it's a huge issue. It's a huge problem that needs to be addressed. We just don't know how to address it because, you know, trauma in each community is different. That's why you can't have a white therapist serve a Black person or Asian person, because the experiences are different. There's no relation there. There's no common ground to kind of uplift each other there. That's just my opinion. So mental health is a huge issue. It's an issue that we're not even ready to address yet. We're trying to find our footing here in the United States. And if you think about it, I came here in 1981. The genocide was over in 1979. So that's not too far from today.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of healing that we have to do as a community, that relates to mental health. And I don't think we've taken a step yet. But and in another way, we do heal as far as music goes, films and arts. That's I see a resurgence in the arts in the Cambodian community, which really you could attribute to bettering the mental health as a community. But as far as addressing the specifics, there's just too much unknowns that I don't know about to even be speaking on it. But I know our parents really need help.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I didn't work with this young lady, but there was a young lady that, we were having like a supervision, you know what I'm saying? Me and a couple of my coworkers, and she was kind of, she brought this case up where one of the students she saw was depressed, like going through depression and kind of, living in a world like being an Asian and then going to a certain high school in Portland. I don't want to, say the name of it, but then she said that, at home she couldn't really get support because her parents would say things like, well, I survived the war. So if I can survive the war, there ain't no reason you should be, sad. So is there like that kind of, is there that kind of attitude, Like
it's exactly that attitude. It's exactly that attitude. It's like, you have no reason to be sad. You have everything that we didn't have growing up. There's a disconnect. There's a generational disconnect. There's a gap there where the second generation and the parent and the child are experienced two different experiences in America, So when they try to talk to each other, that's where they clash. Like you said, I've heard that many times. Like, you shouldn't be sad. You have everything you need. So I don't know how else I can expand on that, but you gave a great an example that triggered something in me. Like, yeah, I've heard that before too, I guess that's how I deal with it. If it's something that doesn't help me or help me improve myself, I just can tend to ignore it.
Yeah. And I feel like, I don't want to downplay, like what, the older generation has been through. Like, I feel like it's fair for them to say that, but it's also fair for them to listen to, because, living in this kind of I'm gonna say from the outside looking in, and I want to say this about myself too, my community, a lot of people who are older kind of have the confidence of knowing their culture. Mm-hmm. So you came from Cambodia, your parents spoke the Cambodian language, and they kind of built their life in Cambodia, and they came over here, right. And they're kind of but they're here. But they're not finding themselves while they're here. At least is, they found themselves enough to come here and start a new life and kind of forget about it. But you and your siblings are we're not really, we are Cambodian, but but this isn't Cambodia. And our students and schools are making fun of me because all this other stuff. So it's I feel their concern is valid. You're right. I've been through a whole lot of stuff, but at the same time, I feel like it's only fair for them to kind of address the struggles of being a person of color, which in a pretty, white dominant space, United States.
Right. Right. No, you're absolutely right. I do agree with that. It's, growing up, we used to get made fun of all the time. I used to get bullied, made fun of Cambodians. There was a song that made fun of us about eating cats and dogs. There's a lot of misunderstanding. You imagine being Cambodian, coming to America, nobody knows what a Cambodian is, So you get grouped in with Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, and you just get made fun of. And, that takes a toll, man. But everyone's handled it different. I think I came out okay. To defend the older generation of not wanting to listen, which I believe they should, because as we get older, I think as adults, you and I, we have a lot to learn from our youth too. Mm-hmm. And in saying that, I think the older generation, my parents, our grandparents who came here before, you know, that brought us here, didn't have the luxury to sit in here and think about mental health or how am I addressing my kids, or they don't they didn't have the luxury, they couldn't afford the luxury to kind of contemplate these things. As soon as they got here, they needed to feed us, find a roof over our heads. So they spent years and years working so long hours, minimum wage jobs, working in the fields. So not to put it all on them, the socioeconomic factors come in to this, come into play too. Because if they're gone 14 hours a day working, trying to put food on the table, and we're, and the children here have no guidance, are getting bullied at school, getting made fun of, and then, and then you're sad when the parents come home just tired as hell. They don't have time to be sad. You feel me? So it's really real. It's really real. It's a topic that needs to be touched and addressed within our community, but I don't know if we're there yet.
Yeah. Do you ever, like, do you see yourself, or do you see it getting there at, ever?
Eventually, yes. I think eventually, yes, as the upcoming generation becomes more aware, when they're afforded the luxury to address mental health, I think we will be. There's a lot of smarter kids than I am coming up, going to school, getting a really good education. So there's hope. There's hope. And we have to, that's why I say the kids, the upcoming generation, is the one we have to look to lead us. And we as adults and parents have to trust that we did a good job of influencing them and raising them to become better.
Do you create that space within your household? Like, you know, like,
Absolutely, man. I both my kids, I hug him and tell him I love him as much as I can every day. Growing up with my parents, I've never heard I love you. You know what I'm saying? It's just, you're supposed to do that. I wasn't a straight A student. I was a C plus, B minus at best, but even every A I got, I was proud of it, but I would never hear I love you or good job. It's like, you're supposed to. Supposed to be getting good grades, right?
This ain't nothing new to us.
We set you up to do well. So, you know, that's also that pressure as well. But to answer your question, yes, I think we will eventually get there.
It's a wonderful thing. You know, I know I say the same thing about the Black community. I feel like we're moving along pretty well. I feel like we still have some misconceptions. Like we like to throw therapy out there, but you know, sometimes therapy ain't the answer. Sometimes the answer is a structural system that we got to fight. You know what I'm saying? And mindfulness your way out of that system. So,
you know. Yeah, it's definitely a layer of complexity for each community. And one good thing about our community that we've you know, came in the 80s, it's not so long, we can look into other communities and see what other communities have done to address these issues too, as an example. So we're not starting from scratch, you know what I mean?
That's, you got some templates to follow. I know when I was like getting into the hip hop social worker thing, my brother had told me about your movement, the Red Scarf movement. You know, he told me about, like, you know, the merch you sell and the kind of like how the merch has like a story behind it and things like that. So I looked at your website and it's very put together. You know, it's very easy to follow. And, you know, I'm saying,
thank you.
And it's, you know, I'm just amazed by people who like, who are able to like really like put their culture on their back and kind of be like, okay, this is what I'm going to take this and I'm going to answer all the, you know, all the confusions people might have about, you know, whatever you heard, you know, misconceptions, I'm going to try to, change the narrative, you know what I'm saying? So you understand, like, you know, what the Red Scarf movement is, you know, but can you like go ahead and kind of. What that is?
Absolutely. The Red Scarf Revolution is mainly a clothing brand, but it's more of a platform to share history. To share the Cambodian history and the hardships that we went through as a people. My main demographic is the younger folks. If you look at the designs that I've created, it's really hip-hop based and influenced as far as the streetwear goes. Growing up, it was always tough to figure out who I was. I didn't have any good Cambodian role models, actually. And I grew up seeing, you know, like Adidas jackets with like United States in the back, Brazil in the back, you know, soccer teams out there. But I've never seen any clothing with the Cambodian culture or the word Cambodia or anything that has to do with our rich culture. So I took it upon myself to really create something for me that for me to wear so I can be proud of. But I created my first t-shirt, put it online. It really resonated. I didn't have a product. I didn't know anything about making t-shirts. I just got a bootleg version of Photoshop about 8 years ago and just started just learning how to use Photoshop, really an experiment and a learning experience for me. So I created this shirt called Can I Get an Encore, which is off the Jay-Z song, right? But yeah. I did Encore, not the word Encore, E-N-C-O-R-E, but Angkor Wat as the temple in Cambodia, spelled A-N-G-K-O-R-R. So it's a play on words, can I get an encore, with the big symbol of the Angkor Wat on it. And it really resonated with people. And the first day I put it online, I sold about 25 t-shirts. You know, I put it online for $25. And I was able to take that money and, I don't know, it just happened really like it was supposed to. I had an ex-coworker that I used to work with who quit the job at Intel, and now he did screen printing. I ran into him randomly, and it's like, yo, I need some screen prints. Then can you do some samples for me?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's how Red Scar Revolution got started, but it was really became, it really become a platform for equality, justice, highlighting atrocities that's been committed worldwide, genocides I focus on, and taking back to what you said earlier with hip hop and connecting with the youth, that's exactly what it is. Red Scar Revolution is more of a is based on Cambodian culture, but hip hop is really the foundation of it as far as promoting the music and the designs and the streetness and the urbanness of those designs and the story behind those designs. So it's become this platform where I can use to connect with people that don't know the history, especially the Cambodian youth that don't know the history. Really, each design is meant to spark up conversation. Every time you would wear a shirt or a hat that I've designed, the goal is to ask somebody, what is that? And then conversation starts. And it seems to work. When I wear it anyway, people ask me what that is. And it's come to a point where I'm kind of annoyed by it, but then I have to realize this is the point.
Yeah.
You know? So Red Scar Revolution is it's a clothing brand, but more of a platform for awareness of our history, because I believe to move forward, we need history to guide us to where we need to go. So it's a vehicle for that mission, where clothing is really in clothing and designs. I mean, my tagline is awareness by design.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really created to connect with the youth, and not with just the Cambodian youth, but anybody who's interested in it. I mean, I have a lot of support from everywhere, from worldwide, from France. I got my latest orders got shipped to Brazil. I never knew we had Cambodians in Brazil, you know? So it's more of a platform than an actual brand. There's a meaning, a force behind it. And I think a lot of kids, a lot of the youth, really gravitate towards it because it's really, like you said, it's the foundation of Red Scar Revolution is hip hop culture.
Mm-hmm. And you know, just to kind of speak on maybe what the youth see, I remember you said that, you know, you didn't have any Cambodian role models, you know what I'm saying? So like, they probably see something like, oh, this is Cambodia making these shirts and it's about my history and it's fresh. You know what I'm saying? Like,
just to feel proud to identify yourself with your culture, I think is huge. I mean, I want everybody to put on a hat that's from Red Scar Revolution or a shirt or jacket. I want them to feel proud when they put that on, because clothing is important, right? Fashion, I think clothing is an art in itself.
Yes,
Piece you put on you, every piece you put on your body is an expression of who you are as a person, the hats, the glasses, I think fashion is important that way in expressing yourself. So when I make these pieces, either a jacket or a t-shirt, I'm really mindful of it on how it makes people feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned that from hip hop. If you go back into the 90s, hip hop, fashion was huge. Being fresh, right? Being fresh is one of the biggest things. And I took that, you know, I took a piece of that and turned it into, to put it into Red Scar Revolution for what it is.
Yeah, being fresh every time you stepped out.
every time. You feel good about yourself because when you feel good and feel confident in what you wear, you go out and it resonates.
Mm-hmm. It's like your energy just pours mm-hmm. off you. Like, oh, man, who is that person? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I definitely get that. Yeah,
you feel proud of who you are.
You know? So now you in the I don't think we got into like you know the details of like the work you do in the community. You know what I'm saying? You mind kind of breaking that down?
Yeah, what I do in the community, I do many things. I've been in the community for a long time now. I'm kind of stepping away to be more of a guide for the upcoming generation to kind of lead and mobilize and organize. One of the issues plaguing our community is deportation. Mm-hmm. So I'm part of an anti-deportation group that advocates and supports all of our brothers and sisters who's been affected by deportation, have been detained or will be detained. I want to talk about a little bit about the Cambodian plight, the community here, the plight of the community here, being wrapped into the crime bill that was passed by Clinton in the 90s, how our community got wrapped up into that too, because when he signed that bill, he opened the door for deportations, right? And if you committed any crime, no matter minor the crime, you could pee in a wall. If you've been convicted of that crime, at that time, it's a deportable offense. So what we're facing now in our community is the injustices of the systemic problem, right? So these guys and girls who have committed a crime when they were teenagers, they could be, you know, 12, 15, 17, 18, no matter what the crime was, it could be a drive-by shooting or if you've stolen a bike. If you've been convicted of that crime and you've already served your time, fast forward 20 years later, you're 35, 38, working every day. You got two kids and a wife. And then all of a sudden, you go check in with ICE and they detain you because your crime is still deportable. And we've had many of our brothers and sisters being deported after already serving their time, which is unconstitutional in our opinion, however you want to interpret the Constitution. But these are legal permanent residents who committed a crime and have already served their time.
Yeah.
And now their mistakes from years and years and years before that is coming to uproot the family. Now you're creating a cycle, If you remove the sole person that creates or bring in the income, the sole provider of the family, what does that happen to the family? And then when your dad or mom gets detained, you're in school as a child, you're not thinking about school, you're thinking about your dad or your mom. That's this thing. So what the past couple of years, the work that I've been involved with is anti-deportation. So I work with a group called the Khmer Anti-Deportation Advocacy Group. There's a website for that too. I think in Washington, we are the main ones in the Cambodian community fighting it. And we've been really successful. I would say we've been really successful. We've gotten a 4 or 5 pardons from our governor. That's the last step. You know, a lot of people don't understand that the criminal and federal is different, right? Right. You have to get your, I'm just rambling now. Anyway, the work that I do is to help families who deserve to be together, stay together, in short. But there's so many layers, and each case is different in between that, and that could be a whole new podcast.
Yeah.
But that's what I've been advocating for within my community. Another piece of the community work that I do, I work for an organization called Tacoma Community House. This organization's been in Tacoma, the Hilltop neighborhood, since 1910. This is our 110th year. Mm-hmm. And we were one of their group that was formed to help immigrants and refugees specifically. First, it was the Slavic community, then the Ukrainians. 1920 was the Filipinos immigrant community. So what Tacoma Community does today, we offer English classes. We offer GED assistance. If you're a victim of crime, we have a crime advocacy department that will help you navigate the legal system if you're an immigrant or refugee. But we serve everyone, but our main demographic are immigrants and refugees because they need the most help in navigating these systems. So what I do at Tacoma Community House, I'm the media and communications persons there. So I do the website, the social media, all the messaging that comes out from the organization is goes through me first. And that I serve the community that way. It's a beautiful story because when my parents came here in the 80s, they actually went to Tacoma Community House to learn English, mm-hmm. get their GED. And then they were all, they also went through the program to help them get their citizenship. So me, for me to go back working there is, it's a real true honor for me to be there after them being there for my family back in the 80s.
Yeah, I dabble.
Yeah, sorry, man. Go ahead.
Oh, it's all good. I was just saying how nice of a story that is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So community work, to me, it's like I said earlier, it's just part of who I am. I don't set out to be this community leader. I've never called myself a community leader. I don't even know what that word means, to be honest. What is a community leader?
Yeah.
I just do what I feel what is necessary, what I'm obligated to, and I just do what I feel what's right for my community and the community that I'm a part of, you know?
Yeah, nice, man. Yeah, community work, you know, I feel like that's something that's like my next step. Because right, I've been doing direct service work for forever, you know, and I kind of want to be like more of a macro person, you know, kind of like what you're doing, you know what I'm saying? But It's really tough to, you know, to get in those positions, especially like, you know, like I'm not really in a position to where I can like, you know, make any less money. So I know like a lot of, you know what I'm saying? So like, and I know it's like important. A lot of community work is, you know, like pays less than a therapist would get paid. So, so I'm trying to figure out a way either, you know what I'm saying? I'll wait till I get my licensure, and then I kind of have, you know, my private practice hustle, and then, like, I have the community hustle. I'm not counting it out right now.
So are you working as a therapist right now?
Yeah, right now, yeah.
That's what's up, man. That's dope.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing it?
I've been a therapist for the greater part of since I got my master's degree for 3 years. So, like, not the whole 3 years, more like two of those 3 years, I was doing therapy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm interested in your story too, man. So tell me more about your project. What is the hip-hop social worker?
Yeah. So basically, you know, when I was in grad school, I was seeing all these, like, social workers that was, like, people would, like, have so much regard for them. Like, oh, my God, I love their work. And I was like, shit. And I was like, what's their credentials? MSW, LCSW? I'm about to have that. I might as well get my thing off, too. And I started it back in grad school, but I didn't know what to do with it. So, like, I just kind of left it alone. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing a podcast for one of my good friends, you know, that I grew up with. And we were trying to build, like, this network. And so I was like, hey, you know what? Mm-hmm. I remember I was doing something called Hip Hop Social Worker. I could, you know, bring that back. So I started doing that podcast. And then when I did the podcast, I made the IG page. And then I was like, you know, I also, the same week, I watched Gary V. You know that Gary V.
So, yeah.
Well, of course, everybody knows Gary V. But he was talking to this young kid, and he was saying like, you know what, like if you really want to be like an influencer, you got to post something every day. And I was like, damn. So I took that. Like kind of idea, and it started like posting like, you know, motivational things, stats on, you know, racism, just things like that, and people just, you know, like people started following. So it just kind of grew into that. But I'm going to turn that into like a private practice to where like I do like, you know, therapy on my own accord and, you know, do like workshops and things like that, you know. So really that's just.
Yeah. That's beautiful, man. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. The therapy part comes because like I've always kind of worked in like around youth, and I've worked in like the juvenile correctional setting for about, I want to say the last maybe 8 years, you know, and I never seen black therapists, you know, never seen a black therapist.
You ain't lying.
You know, but we always work with kids of color, black kids, Hispanic kids, you know, Asian kids. For like a therapist that looks like them, you know, so
Representation is important.
you know what I'm saying? So I took it upon myself to, like, you know, go back and get my master's degree and to kind of be a person, you know, that looks like the youth that I serve. And not because I'm trying to, like, fit in, but it's like, but, like, this is kind of, like, this is really how I dress, how I talk, how I walk, you know what I'm saying? Like, I might, you know, think, you know, yeah, go down a button down. But if I'm wearing a button down and slacks, I'm still wearing J's, you know what I'm saying? So, like,
yeah,
you know, it's
that's just the hip hop of it all, man.
You know what I'm saying? And I speak, I just speak the way I speak to you, I speak to them, you know what I'm saying? And it's really just kind of,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying, like, simplify things, because I can speak a whole lot of psychobabble, you know what I'm saying, or, you know, jargon, you know what I'm saying? But
yeah,
but
yeah.
How, but who, like, who understands that besides the people who studied it?
You know? Right.
So, but it's, well, really, that's my journey. Just trying to make hip, just trying to make social work be appealable to anyone, you know what I'm saying? You
ain't, yeah, gotta, be accessible. Yeah, see, be, know, accessible and have, draw people in and make them feel comfortable. Yeah. And not, you're, it's not this space where you can be yourself and not this professional therapist person, which leads, yeah, me to my next question. Mm-hmm. In your line of work, as a therapist, I know you, there's a lot of, it's majority a white space. Mm-hmm. And being who you are, being who we are, the way we speak, the way we talk, the way we dress, is not necessarily up to the professional standards of white people, right? How do you code switch? Do you code switch when you have to? Or is it just something that comes out naturally? Or,
yeah,
I mean, where, you know, that, my question is, how do you code switch from being who you are to being your professional you?
So, I mean, the only thing I do really is the code switch is, like, I might, you know, wear, you know, like I said, I might wear a button up and slacks to work, you know, so most of the time, I don't, like the biggest thing, I don't say the N word at work, you know what I'm saying? Know, that's one thing that I don't do, you know, and really, and I don't know. I feel like I don't code switch, like, to a extreme degree, you know, like, I might,
yeah,
you know, saying, there's some jokes I don't say because, you know, and there's some references I won't make because, like, you probably don't get that reference, or you might think that reference is inappropriate, you know? So, right. It's really just kind of like checking, like, some things at the door, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yep.
Okay, let me make sure I'm not getting too, you know what I'm saying, too honest in this space, because sometimes people get offended by the honesty that I might, you know, give out. You know, so it does suck, because, like, I wish I worked around, like, people that I kind of, like, you know, that look like the way I look, you know what I'm saying? And especially, like, in, like, the therapy space, because, like, in the therapy space, it's mostly women, and then it's, like, mostly, like, white women, you know what I'm saying? There's a few women of color, but they present as white, you know, and that's, you know, that's irrelevant, but I'm saying, but, like, as far as, like, you know, like black males of color, you know, I'm the only one in that space, you know? So I hold like an interesting position, because, you know, like, I have to be, like, kind of like the bridge of, like, culture for the youth and for the staff, you know what I'm saying?
Right,
so
it's
kind of, it gets tricky sometimes, but code switching, yeah, I just kind of be mindful of the things that I say, you know what I'm saying? I speak with a stutter, so, like, I can't switch my language up too much, because I'm going to start stuttering hella. So you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? So I speak with slang, and you're going to get slang, because that's just kind of how I train my brain to hinder the stuttering, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so, you know what I'm saying? So if I try to go too far from that, it ain't going to be cool. So, like, you might – so I wish I said things more articulate, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I feel like I articulate myself enough, you know?
Yeah.
But I just can't. That's just, I train my brain to work a certain way. And if I go too far off the course, I'm not saying nothing. So, you know.
Yeah. I understand. You lose yourself. I'm the same way. We have a dress code at work in the office. And when I first started, I would, you know, go into, because we're not allowed to wear anything but slacks and a button-up shirt. But I'm a couple years deep into the organization.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I look like how I look today. You know, yeah. I got my hat, cap on, my hoodie on, my jeans on.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, you know, being the organization that it is very lenient and flexible. I haven't really, no one's really said anything to me yet.
Yeah.
And it's just, I'm more comfortable that way. You feel me? Like the way I talk too, I'm sitting in meetings with our ED and our board members, and I have to go back to where I'm comfortable with my language, you know, the, like you said, the slang. Like if I start trying to speak as properly as everybody else, nothing's coming out.
Nothing at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And even in a board meeting, I throw a cuss word here and there.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes out. If I get reprimanded for it, then fine. But so far it's been pretty non, there's been no resistance on my behavior. So yeah. I'm pretty lucky.
Yeah. The one thing about like therapists, especially like the ones that work in like a juvenile setting, we're all kind of quirky. So mm-hmm. We all have our quirks. And so like, and that's one thing I am fortunate about, because I'm not the only one. Like, if I were to curse in a meeting, I'm not the only one that would do that. So, like,
right,
you know, like, cool. I ain't got to be put on blast about that. But it is hard, because, you know, like, I feel like a lot of people think I take it easy on the youth, mm-hmm. but it's like, I'm not really taking it easy. Like, it's just, I understand where they come from. I don't get shocked when they say like these awful things, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I don't take what mm-hmm. they say verbatim, you know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of them are just, you know, talking to make themselves feel comfortable, you know what I'm saying? So, like, it's not like when it's a concern, I address the concern, you know what I'm saying? But if it's just me and them talking, you know, and just talking and they say something crazy, it's like, that's not really. You know,
I think that's a huge value to you and what you do, and it's a huge value to the kids that you're serving too, because you're meeting them where they at.
You have to.
You know what I'm saying? That's important, because if you try to bring them to where you are, nothing's ever going to get done. There's a disconnect there. So if you could meet them where they at and make them feel mm-hmm. comfortable, you can. The potential is limitless. You know what I mean?
And that's a social work code of ethics. So you know what I'm saying? Like, you're supposed to meet the client where they're at. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. you're not supposed to hold them to your standard. A lot of youth I work with are, you know what I'm saying, 22, 23, well, that's not youth, but you know, but in state of Oregon, if you're in that system, you're a youth until you're 25. Mm-hmm. And like 17, 15, that age, like I'm 34 years old, I'd have been to college, I'd have been to a whole lot of stuff, so for me to expect them to kind of like behave like I behave, you know, or to understand, like, you know saying, like the big words that I say, it's not fair, you know.
There's no need for that,
you know. So before we get out of here, I like to talk to everybody about self-care, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do for self-care?
Every Sunday, I turn off all of my notifications. I usually don't turn on my, I don't check my email. I check social media here and there, but as far as text messages goes, returning phone calls, any meetings on Sundays, usually Sundays, my blackout days. I like to hang out with the family. We go on our bike rides and smoke a lot of weed, man.
Hey, there we go.
Self-care, man.
Yes, sir.
I have a lot of anxiety. Weed calms that down a little bit. So mm-hmm. I do that. And I also just consume things that I think will benefit me. Listen to the music I like to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Continue to read books that, you know, tickles my fancy.
Mm-hmm.
And just shutting off, unplugging is a huge, huge way of self-care for me, because I work on the internet, social medias. I manage a couple social media accounts for the organizations, my own stuff, and just unplugging. That's my main method of self-care, unplugging and getting high.
Yes, sir. Relaxing, zoning out.
Yes.
Getting that
yes.
vibe right.
Yeah. Well, what about you?
Oh, man, shit. Self-care for me, I ain't gonna lie. Man, I really don't. Like, I really don't have answers for people, because I don't do stuff enough to, like, mm-hmm. for it to be, like, a thing. So, like, but really, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I try to relax as much as possible, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? I really go to my backyard, chill, you know what I'm saying?
Reflect a little bit.
Look at nature, you know what I'm saying? I unplug, too. I don't check work emails at home at all. I don't mm-hmm. care. Nothing. I don't give a shit. I'm not checking work emails at home. Playing video games, you know, exercising whenever, you know, I don't do that a lot, but when I do it, I feel mm-hmm. I do feel good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really trying to learn things, you know what I'm saying? Like I've kind of like tapped this like creativeness inside of me. So like I'm trying to like, you know, I'm getting into photography, doing things like that.
There you go.
You know, spend time with my family. You know, my daughter, she kind of keeps me grounded. You know, being a father is interesting because like kids get on your nerves.
They sure do every day.
You know what I'm saying? But it's like, you also know that the world would be a lot worse without them here. So it's like, yeah, you get on my nerves right now, but I never want to be too mad at you because I don't want to take you for granted. And you know what I'm saying? If something happens, I don't have you anymore, you know, then I'll be super fucked up. So I feel like it's like a good like way to like balance my like, you know, like, okay, I get upset, but don't stay upset because you really don't want to see what the other side of that is like. So
So I feel your pain, man. I feel your pain. I got a 10 and a 13-year-old. He's turning 13 soon, and I don't know how old your kids are, but my kids are, you know, they're at an age where they can talk and think for themselves, and everything that you've taught them, they're throwing it back at you. You know, I want my daughter to be the strong, independent, strong-headed, persistent person that don't take shit from nobody. She's exactly that.
You know.
So. Well, I'm proud of that, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's still annoying.
Yeah, like, damn, am I going to be so good at that? But, so my self-care is random, you know what I'm saying? I might go in the backyard, twist something up, too, and, you know, let whatever happens, you know what I'm saying? Just kind of reflect on things. But really, you know, hip-hop social work has really been something that's self-care for me, especially because, like, the positive feedback that I get from it is kind of, like, building my confidence up to, you know, because I do these podcasts, and you never really know, like, you know what I'm saying, what people think about it. So, like, to hear even, like, a few people say, like, oh, man, your last episode was spot on, or, you know, I appreciate the guests you had on because they taught me a lot about something I didn't even think about. So, you know, so really just kind of tapping in with different, you know, different people in the field is really, like, it is a form of self-care. And I don't, like, overbear myself with it because, like, you know, because when I first started getting like responses and people like hit me up like, oh man, you know what I'm saying, I'm trying to be a social worker, what to do, I would try to reply to everybody, you know what I'm saying? My wife was like, you know, maybe you should probably like not be so quick to, you know, like, you know, let them wait for a little bit, you know. So I try, like,
it's a learning process. It's a learning process,
definitely. Hey, you know.
Do you have a website?
I do.
Okay, you share that with me. I think I haven't you probably have it on there already, but if you get the same questions all the time, maybe you have a FAQ section on the website, you know, so you just direct people there. Like, people ask me stupid shit, the same shit all the time, like, working about a shirt or what size is that, and I have pre templates to answer these questions, you know.
Okay, that's a good idea, you know. But but then with that, like, everything else is like, I guess, like, people ask me, like, so how'd you get into the field? And I was like, well, go to the website, figure that out, you know, I guess. I appreciate you, brother, for joining me. You know what I'm saying?
Thanks for having me, man.
Yes, sir. I feel like we all need to get our voices out, especially the community workers, people who are out here fighting for justice, you know what I'm saying, fighting for change, calling people out, you know what I'm saying, because getting deported for something you did 20 years ago ain't cool. And, you know what I'm saying?
And a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of mis...
Yeah, for real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and like, shake up that family structure. To me, that's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're really just leaving kids out here to fend for themselves.
Uprooting the family, man. I mean, if you think about uprooting the family, it's part of the U.S. history, man. Ever since slaves being separated to deportation. And now it's happening today at our border. The families come and try to for a better life. The first thing they do, the strategy they do is separate the kids from their parents. It's inhumane.
Yeah.
Man.
But like, that's a whole nother podcast. So I'd say
a whole nother podcast.
Well, man, I appreciate you, bro.
No doubt. Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. Peace.